Good morning. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak to you today. It truly is an honor. This is genuinely one of my favorite things to do is to teach you about Jesus. And so I'm very excited to do this. Goodness. Do I need to adjust anything, Andrew? All right. Today, there I am, we're going to talk about kingdom. Paul has been in a series on kingdom this year, and so I'm going to continue that. And last week, we heard from Scotty last week, and he talked about God, the good father, right? And so these two themes are going to come together really interestingly today for us, okay? I've had this message planned for probably upwards of a year or so. I've been talking about this with the youth and the life group that I co-lead. This is not a topic that I have shied away from over the last year, and yet it just so happens that I am delivering this message on kings and kingdoms to you right now in the midst of everything going on in our country today. This wasn't planned, and not by me anyway, but I am nevertheless excited to do this. If you would, I'm going to invite you to join me in prayer again, because I like to pray before I speak. So, Father, thank you for this time to dive into your word, for this time to commune with one another, but ultimately, Lord, and most importantly, to commune with you as we hear from you this morning. I pray, Father, that you would guide us in this space, comfort us in this space, touch us in this space, move in and amongst us, challenge us, transform us, teach us something that we don't know, teach us something about you, about ourselves, and the world around us. In Jesus' name, amen. All right, like I said, we're going to talk about kingdom today. Turn with me to Romans chapter 12. Romans chapter 12, we're going to start in verse 1. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present yourselves, to present your bodies, as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. That all sounds pretty good to me. I like the way that sounds, but how do we do that, right? Luckily, Paul continues here. Do not be conformed to this world, literally, in the Greek, it says, do not be conformed to this age, to this time that you live in, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. I really like the way the NIV reads this. I'm reading out of the ESV this morning, but I really like the way the NIV renders the first part of verse 2. The NIV says, do not be conformed to the pattern of this world. That's not present literally in the Greek, but I really like the way that sounds, and that's how we're going to approach it today. The idea of this pattern that the world follows. Okay, so keep that in mind as we move forward, okay? Do not be conformed to the pattern of this world, but be transformed. Paul refers to something that we call the pattern of the world, okay? And whatever this means, Paul believes it to be not good. How do I know this? Because he tells me not to be conformed to it. Whatever it is, I am supposed to avoid it and instead be transformed into something else by the renewal of my mind, right? He's not the only biblical author that talks about the world in this way, okay? James in James chapter 4 says that friendship with the world is enmity with God. To be a friend of the world is to be an enemy of God. That's really harsh language, right? That's really intense language. Before this, again, in James chapter 4, James says that we covet and we desire things. The implication being that what we desire is incongruous with what God desires, okay? And as a result, this breeds conflict. Right? James uses this as a way to talk about the conflict that brews between people, right? But he essentially says that you covet and you desire things, and this breeds conflict. And then he says to be a friend of the world is to be an enemy of God. So James apparently is tying these two ideas together into a vision of what the world is, what this pattern of the world is, so to speak, okay? The pattern of the world is, at its core, self-centeredness, a drive to serve the self above all else, right? The world values wealth, strength, and might, dedication to myself first, seeking my own way and whichever vices help me get there along the way, and sowing conflict along the way as long as it gets me to my goal. This is the pattern of the world, okay? This thing exists within each and every one of us. I know you know what I'm talking about, okay? This sinful nature of humanity, right? The pattern of the world. Now, if there is a pattern of the world that Paul apparently, and James for that matter, and other biblical authors as well, they're not alone here, if there is a pattern of the world that I am to resist and not conform to, it stands to reason that there is a different pattern, an opposite pattern, that I am to move towards, that I am to strive for, and that I am to conform to. Right? Paul continues by telling us to be transformed, right, by the renewal of my mind. And apparently this transformation will help me experience God in a way that I get to see his will, and it's good, and it's pleasing, and it's perfect for me. Right? So suddenly a different pattern emerges, and in this pattern, I can test and see the will of God. I want that, right? So now the question is, what is this pattern? And to answer that, we need to turn to Matthew chapter 4. So the first four chapters of Matthew serve as an introduction to this letter, and then what follows is a series of speeches that Jesus gives to the people following him, right? And so this first section of Matthew, we're told stories such as stories about his birth, John the Baptist, Jesus' baptism, and then Jesus is tempted in the wilderness. And then chapter 4 ends with Jesus beginning his ministry in earnest, okay? So we're going to pick up in chapter 4, verse 17. From that time, Jesus began to preach, saying, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." This word kingdom is our key word, of course, today. And the word kingdom is the absolute key word in the Gospel of Matthew as a whole, okay? No other book in the Bible uses the word kingdom more than the book of Matthew, okay? Luke and the book of Daniel come close, and no other book comes close to these three, okay? The word kingdom appears around 55 times in the book of Matthew. So Matthew is all about kingdom, specifically what Jesus calls the kingdom of heaven, okay? Now this word kingdom, I don't have to tell you to use your imagination too hard here, right? This word kingdom produces some very specific imagery and ideas in our minds, okay? Especially for us as Americans, right? A country founded on the idea that a single person has no business ruling over and being the authority over an entire society, right? We come to this discussion, we come to this idea of kingdom with a bias predisposed in our minds, right? We have a bias about what a king is, what a king does, and whether or not that is good for me, okay? And this is, again, especially true for us as Westerners, especially true for us as Americans, okay? It's a very complicated and loaded word, right? This word kingdom also conjured some very specific thoughts and emotions for the Jewish people listening to Jesus at this time, okay? At this time, Israel is not so much a nation as really the province of Judea occupied by the Empire of Rome, okay? For Rome, kingdom meant conquest, kingdom meant might versus right, right? Whatever Caesar said, that was kingdom, okay? For Israel, they grew up with the idea that one day a man would come who would restore them as a nation to global prominence, right? That a man would come one day, strike down all of their oppressors, and then reestablish Israel as a great and mighty nation amongst all the other nations, okay? This is what Israel, what these Jewish people who know the scriptures, okay? This is what these people thought of when you talk about the word kingdom, okay? Let's continue. Verse 23. And he went throughout all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction among the people. So his fame spread throughout all Syria, and they brought him all the sick, those afflicted with various diseases and pains, those oppressed by demons, those having seizures and paralytics, and he healed them. And great crowds followed him from Galilee and the Decapolis, and from Jerusalem and Judea, and from beyond the Jordan. So this statement is Matthew's summary of the entire ministry of Jesus, okay? He went throughout all of Galilee, all of Judea, preaching about what he calls the gospel of the kingdom, okay? Jesus recognized that there is a way that the world functions, a pattern, if you will, and that this pattern leads us down a path of destruction and death and chaos, yes. Right? And Jesus came to confront and challenge this pattern and present us with a new pattern, right? A path that leads to transformation and life instead, all right? He calls this new path the kingdom of heaven, all right? So when Jesus talks about kingdom, this is what he's talking about. He is talking about this new pattern that stands as in opposition to the established, deeply ingrained pattern of humanity, okay? And so we read these verses, right? And we're told that Jesus came to teach us about the kingdom of heaven. We read verse 23 that says that he went about proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom. And the natural question that follows is, what is this kingdom? What does this kingdom look like? And fortunately, we need only to keep reading, right? The next chapter, chapter 5, is the very beginning of what we call the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 5, 6, and 7 are the Sermon on the Mount. This is the first of a series of speeches that Jesus gives in the book of Matthew. And I want to establish the cultural, even especially modern cultural significance of the Sermon on the Mount, okay? Imagine, or even remember, back to when you were a new Christian, or maybe you are now a new Christian or contemplating this idea of Jesus and Christianity, right? For most people in that space, they want to know about Jesus. We've heard about this Jesus guy. Give me Jesus, right? Because let's be honest, if you don't know what's going on here and you start in the beginning, you're going to have a rough time, right? But if I want to know about Jesus, I'm going to go to the Gospels first, okay? And there's no better to start in the Gospels than the beginning of the Gospels, which is Matthew, right? So you're going to read a few chapters of stories, and you're going to go, okay, that's cool, but give me what Jesus has to say. And you're finally going to come to Matthew chapter 5, which is the very beginning of the teachings of Jesus. So you can see, I hope anyway, that that illustrates to you the importance of the Sermon on the Mount. If you want to know what Jesus stands for, if you want to know who he is, and if you want to know about his kingdom, you start with the Sermon on the Mount, okay? We are going to read the very first part of the Sermon on the Mount, which is what we call the Beatitudes. This is the introduction. This is essentially Jesus' opener, all right? He begins with, again, what we call the Beatitudes. These are nine statements where he's going to refer to a certain group of people, and he's going to call them blessed. And then he's going to follow that blessing with a promise of a future reality that reverses the first part of the statement, okay? You'll see what I'm talking about here in a second. Here is where Jesus presents us from the very beginning, a new pattern of living, a new way to live, a better way, I think, okay? So what I encourage you to do and challenge you to do as we read these verses, read these patterns that Jesus establishes, and examine your own life to see which of these patterns you identify as strengths within you, but then also to identify which of these are patterns that you struggle with, patterns that you see in your own life that you know need to be transformed, a pattern that you need to no longer conform to and instead be transformed and follow a different pattern, okay? So, let's start reading. I'm actually going to go back to chapter 4, verse 23, because I want you to see the context here. All right? And he went throughout all Galilee, teaching in their synagogues and proclaiming the gospel of the kingdom and healing every disease and every affliction among the people. So his fame spread throughout all Syria, and they brought him all the sick, those afflicted with various diseases and pains, those oppressed by demons, those having seizures and paralytics, and he healed them. And great crowds followed him from Galilee and the Decapolis and from Jerusalem and Judea, and from beyond the Jordan. I read that again to give you the context. This is the group of people that he is working with. He has been brought a bunch of sick people, a bunch of poor people, right? A bunch of very underprivileged people. These are the people following Jesus, okay? This is going to inform how we read the Beatitudes moving forward. Chapter 5, verse 1. Seeing the crowd, this crowd that he just brought us at the end of chapter 4, seeing the crowd, he went up on the mountain, and when he sat down, his disciples came to him. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." We're going to go through these one by one. I don't know if I'm going to have time to cover everything in detail, but we're going to move through these one by one, okay? This first statement is so loaded. Again, I just showed you the type of people that are coming to follow Jesus. I'm just going to be honest with you. He's not exactly getting the most privileged people in Judea and Rome at this time. The people following Jesus are those who are underprivileged. I wonder why, right? And he opens the very first thing that Matthew tells us he teaches us. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Okay? The world has decided that this group of people, to be harsh, are worthless. Okay? Jesus knows what he's doing by starting off this way. Okay? He's been brought the poor, the sick, the probably unhoused, right? Whatever. You know the group of people that I'm talking about here. And you know, as well as I do, that this is a group of people that is not just underprivileged, they are undervalued in society, right? This is still true today. I don't think I need to stretch your imagination very hard for you to see that, okay? And this is the group of people that Jesus begins speaking to, and he calls them blessed. This is absolutely radical speaking here. Okay? To tell this group of people that you are blessed in this kingdom. These people are poor, they're sick, they're oppressed by the Roman Empire, and in some ways even oppressed by their own Jewish religious elite of the time. Okay? The last thing these people feel is blessed. The last thing these people feel is blessed. And yet this is the language that Jesus uses. The world has decided that you are insignificant, you are unimportant, but in my kingdom, you are of utmost importance. Not only are you of utmost significance in my kingdom, this kingdom, my kingdom, belongs to you. Yes. It's yours. Right? He tells a group of people who have few to no earthly possessions that an entire kingdom belongs to them. Imagine what that does to a group of people like this. Right? It's no wonder Jesus was so popular, right? Verse 4, blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. There's a nice logical flow here from verse 3 to verse 4 here, okay? If you don't have a lot of resources, it stands to reason that you are experiencing lack, right? Potentially because you have had at one point and have been lost, right? This can refer to your resources. This can refer to your loved ones. This can refer to your health. Whatever it is, whatever you're lacking that makes you poor in spirit in verse 3, you very likely mourn that loss, right? You very likely mourn that lack, okay? And of course, this word mourning conjures up other thoughts, you know, specifically about, you know, death and mortality, contemplating our own mortality and the mortality of those around us. This just got very sad all of a sudden, but I hope I'm not surprising you here, okay? Grief is a very natural part of life. It's a very understandable, significant even part of life, important part of life, okay? And Jesus was very and is very empathetic to this, right? He seems to identify that the people gathering around him are experiencing great lack and great loss, right? And as a result, he calls them blessed, right? And he tells them that you will be comforted, right? Verse 5, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. This word meek deserves its own sermon. Each and every one of these could be its own sermon, right? This word meek specifically deserves its own sermon. We tend to treat this word as if it means weakness, probably because it rhymes. But that's not really what's going on here in the language and in the context in which it was used, right? It more accurately means to be afflicted out of a status of unimportance and insignificance, okay? The Greek word is praus. Repeat after me, praus. Good job, you just learned some Greek. The Hebrew equivalent is anav. Anav? All right. These words mean roughly the same thing. The verb in Hebrew is anav, which means to defile or to afflict or to abuse, okay? And in order to afflict or to defile or abuse something, you have to first determine that that thing is insignificant. To do this to a person is to not just determine that this person is insignificant, you have to first determine that they are not even human. Right? Okay? So in a way, meekness is, I wouldn't even call it weakness. We do use it to mean that, but it's not. It's a status, not even a status, it is to be deemed by something else unimportant. That's at least the biblical understanding of it. Okay? The anav in the Old Testament, there are many authors that refer to a group of people as anav. These are significantly and culturally unimportant, those who have not compared to those who have, right? King David, when he's on the run in the wilderness, refers to himself as ani because he has an oppressor that's chasing after him that has deemed him insignificant and less than human, okay? A social outsider, outcast, right? And Jesus instead calls these people blessed, right? Blessed are the meek. And then he continues, for they shall inherit the earth. The literal language there meaning land, right? This is incredibly political language now, as if it wasn't already, right? This is about wealth. This is about status. This is about the means of generating wealth. This is about that land is a common denominator usually between those who have and those who have not, especially in this culture that he's speaking to. Okay? Jesus is being intentionally provocative here. Okay? Again, this is not a group of people that are accustomed to being treated as anyone of significance. And yet, Jesus tells them that they have an inheritance waiting from them. He's already told them, this entire kingdom is yours, right? Blessed are you who are meek because you will inherit land. Right? He's communicating to these people who feel meek, who feel afflicted, who feel insignificant, right? That they are actually held in great honor in his kingdom. That's what this is about. You have been deemed honored to receive this. Right? That's the whole point. You're honored with this inheritance, right? Verse 6, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. This is very similar rhetoric as with the poor in spirit rhetoric, right? These are poor people, and so it stands to reason that many of them are hungry, right? And so again, it's hard to feel blessed when you're hungry, right? It's hard to feel blessed when you can't afford to feed yourself or afford to feed your family, right? God's desire, Jesus' desire, is for this place to be heaven on earth, right? And yet it doesn't take much. Again, I don't have to stretch your imagination hard for you to see that it doesn't look like heaven on earth down here, right? And so we look to the world, the whole point here, this hunger and thirst for righteousness, we look to the world and we're starved because we desperately want to see righteousness done in this life and in this world. We desperately want to see heaven on earth and we don't see it and we're starved for it. We hunger for righteousness to be done. We thirst to see righteousness done, right? This is to hold a desire to treat each other rightly. This is what righteousness means according to the Bible, right? I don't have time to really give you the details. I really wish I could. But righteousness is to exist in right relationship with another person, right? To exist in right relationship between me and my wife, between me and my friends and my family, to exist in right relationship between me and God, okay? It's an external thing. It's not it begins internally. We'll see that here in a second. But it's an external thing to make this relationship between me and you right, okay? And for God, this means that we, again, maintain a right relationship with him as well, which is about obedience in a way, okay? But it's also about knowing that God will always treat us rightly, right? And so we choose to pursue him, experience his goodness and love him enough to do right by him, okay? And Jesus promises that those who hunger and thirst and seek in this way, he tells them, they will be satisfied. If you pursue this righteousness, if you pursue right relationship with others, if you encourage right relationships between others that you see, right? He tells you that you will be fed, that you will be satisfied. So far, all of this sounds really nice. But then he gets to verse 7. He says, "Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy." All right? Israel had a very interesting political structure at this time. They were occupied by the Roman Empire. I've already went through this a little bit, right? Who were some of the most ruthless people to have ever existed on this planet. Okay, they sat around in think tanks and devised way to torture people, all right? And they were very good at it. Interestingly, Rome, however, allowed Israel to, or Judea rather, the province of Judea, they allowed Judea to relatively govern themselves in respect to religious matters. As long as it didn't interfere with Roman policy and Roman business, you're more or less free to do whatever you like, at least in terms of your religiosity, okay? And what that created then was, well, it was already in process. This is so nuanced and so complicated, but this led to specific Jewish religious elite groups such as the Sadducees and the Pharisees, right, who became a source of oppression themselves, right, and became an oppressive group upon the people of Judea as well as the Roman Empire, okay? So you can see that in this landscape, mercy was not a common way of interacting with the world, or at least with this group of people, okay? And again, it doesn't take much imagination to realize that this oppressed group of people probably didn't reserve much mercy within themselves for the in-group, right? In many ways, this is very human, this is very understandable, right? And yet, here's this Jesus guy telling you that you are blessed if you show mercy. And this goes beyond just like the political and social dynamic between the Roman Empire and the Jewish elite versus the poor Jewish people. This goes beyond this. I mean, we're also talking about me and my wife, right? Or me and my buddy Scotty, right? Whatever this right relationship thing that he talks about when we hunger and thirst for righteousness, whenever that breaks down, he's talking about that relationship too, right? The idea that I, instead of pursuing justice as I define it, because that's the key here, right? I instead choose to be merciful. I instead choose to be compassionate. I instead choose to forgive. Right? This is difficult. This is the first one that's truly challenging, I think. I can get behind this Jesus guy telling me that I'm blessed even though I'm poor and sick. I can get behind him telling me that if I desire for good relationships between me and other people, then I'm blessed. Right? I can get behind that. It's really difficult for me to get behind the idea that I'm supposed to be compassionate for those that I have decided are not worthy of compassion, right? This is the first one that truly digs at our core in a way that is uncomfortable, but even convicting, right? But Jesus seems to believe that harboring resentment and hatred of others, even toward those who harm us, even if we feel they deserve it, right? He believes this is ultimately destructive to a society and to a group of people, especially if the goal is to create heaven on earth, right? He seems to believe that we ought to extend forgiveness and kindness to those around us and treat people with true, genuine love, generous love and care, right? After all, how on earth are we supposed to create these right relationships from verse 6 if we don't do this, if we perpetuate this state of hatred or discontent or resentment between me and the people around me, especially those that I love, right? How are we supposed to create right relationship if I'm harboring these emotions for the people around me, people that I'm supposed to be building up and helping conform to something better, a better pattern? Gosh, I'm running out of time. Summary so far. Blessed are you who are poor in spirit, who have been deemed unimportant, who mourn your losses, and blessed are you for seeing the pain and injustice around you and still longing for righteousness in your life and the world around you. And blessed are you for choosing to be someone who shows compassion and love in order to be a source of right relationship, especially for those who don't deserve it. That sounds like such a better way, right? This is a better way. Verse 8, we're going to move through the rest of these pretty quickly, I think. Verse 8, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. So righteousness is that external state of being between me and someone else, right? Purity is the internal part of that, the internal component. They go hand in hand, right? We use this in very specific terms that I actually find to be largely unhelpful in our Christian society because they mean more, so much more than just talking about sexuality, okay? It's so much more than that. Okay? I just don't have time to get into it. but it is this internal thing that motivates me toward the heart of God. Okay? And as a result, my outward behavior reflects that to create righteousness, to create right relationship. Okay? I encounter the overwhelming goodness of God and allow Him to transform me into something new internally. Right? Something with a heart to experience Him and share the goodness of others. This is what it means to be pure. Okay? Verse 9, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Again, probably one that stings a little bit for some of us, right? Some of us on this side of the spectrum are deeply uncomfortable with conflict and seek to avoid it at all costs, right? I find myself leaning more towards this side of the spectrum. There are others, people that I truly don't understand, who, for people like me on this side, seem at least to revel in the conflict. That's not a very fair way of characterizing them, I'm aware, but people who are not afraid to get into it, right? Either quick to defend, quick to attack, and to be fair, we need people like this to some degree, right? I think we need the other side too, but what I think is going on, I think Jesus is not so much advocating for the middle, but a perfect blend of both. Right? He's not talking about people who are avoiding conflict in order to maintain the status quo of peace in your little bubble. And he's certainly not talking about this group of people over here who are quick to attack and are quick to defend and breed more conflict. Because let's be real, that's what happens with both camps here, right? The conflict never truly goes away with both of these parties. Okay? He's talking about people. He says the word here is peacemaker. Someone who steps into a space of conflict, a space of chaos, and becomes an agent of order and peace instead. He's talking about a group of people who are willing to step into these spaces, right, and get your hands dirty, right, and get uncomfortable, and make other people uncomfortable, and be an agent that brings peace as a result. You see that? It takes a much greater strength to realize that peace is a greater goal to strive for than conflict, even in times when justice is needed as I define it, right? And this runs entirely counter to our sensibilities, okay? Again, Jesus is saying this to a group of people who are occupied by a foreign oppressive government, right? How much more would he say this to us who, for the most part, this isn't universally true, but for most of us, the worst we're going to have to encounter is somebody who thinks differently than us, right? Right? How much more would he say that to us? Nearly skipped the last part. Verse 10, The last few verses here are all combined into one, sort of. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. Rejoice and be glad. What a crazy thing to say. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward is great in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Jesus has spent a lot of time here talking about what his kingdom looks like. This is the behavior of the people of the Jesus kingdom. And if you behave in this way, you are going to look different, because this is not the established pattern of humanity. This is not the established way of living and path that humanity follows, right? You are going to look different, and it is going to bring conflict your way, right? You are going to be persecuted. You are going to be undersold, right? You are going to be ridiculed, slandered, torn down in public forum and in private discourse, physically harmed, and even sadly killed for their faith and dedication to Jesus. And this is especially true, of course, in more oppressive nations where they lack, you know, basic religious liberties, of course. Again, this is not a fate that anyone would just welcome joyfully. This is not a fate. I mean, I'll admit, like, maybe you find people don't feel this way, but I'll admit this doesn't sound very fun to me, right? And yet Jesus says to rejoice and be glad, yeah. Right? And he says you are blessed for this. Okay. Verse 10, he repeats that same line from verse 3. He says, "For theirs is the kingdom of heaven." He's wrapping this up in a nice little bow and tying it back up and calling back to that first section there intentionally, right? Those who persevere, those who choose this way of living, this path of living, this pattern of living, right, who seek Jesus as their guide, they are adopted into something much greater than this world has to offer, something that Jesus calls, again, the kingdom of heaven. So again, getting back to the top of this, the word kingdom conjured some very specific thoughts for these people at the time. They conjure some very specific thoughts for the people of us, or people here now, today. But beyond our idea of kingdom, right, these verses challenge patterns of thinking that are universal to the human experience. In the world we live in, those who are rich, those who are healthy, those who are beautiful, those who are outspoken, those who are powerful, this is considered to be the privileged, favored, and blessed group of people. Okay? But then Jesus speaks, right? And he reveals what his kingdom is about. And he reveals that his kingdom, the Jesus kingdom, is a complete inverse, is a complete opposition to our view of kingdom, right? To our view, to this established pattern, right? In his kingdom and economy, the first shall be last, and the last will be first, right? In his kingdom, those who are poor are blessed. Those who are persecuted are blessed. Those who show mercy and seek peace instead of conflict are blessed. And where the world values power, status, and privilege, Jesus values peace, wisdom, and humility. And instead of a warmongering conqueror that the Jewish people were expecting, what they got instead was Jesus of Nazareth, a poor carpenter from the boonies who came on the scene and talked about love and generosity and forgiveness, right? It's really no wonder that Jesus was so popular, as the end of chapter 4 tells us, right? And we're given, through these verses, an idea of his kingdom, of course, and every kingdom needs a king, right? So we're given an idea of what this king is like. And I have to tell you, I don't know about you fine people, but this looks like a really good king to me. This looks like a really good king, a man that I would gladly follow and hopefully be willing to die for. Right? The purpose here is not that we are expected to legalistically and rigorously adhere to this list of things that Jesus has put forward, right? But that we strive for something better instead, right? That's not the purpose. The purpose that he's getting at here, this is an introduction to his identity, an introduction to the identity of his kingdom, right? What he's doing here is saying, this is what my kingdom is about. Right? So the natural question that follows now is, am I down with this kingdom? Am I down with this kind of king? Do I want to be a part of this kind of kingdom? Or do I instead want to stay in this kingdom, one, on a path of destruction and chaos and death? Do I instead want to be a part of a kingdom that is on a path toward transformation and life instead? Right? If you do, if the answer is yes to any of those questions, there's an invitation. Right? To be clear, as I've already said, there is no expectation here that we be perfect. There's no expectation that that if we don't follow these things, then we're suddenly out of the kingdom, right? There is no condemnation. There is no shame or guilt in the kingdom of heaven, right? The goal is to recognize that this good king came to present us with a pattern of living that is counter to the patterns humanity has created for itself and counter to the thing within me that seeks to establish me as king of my life, right? Because that's what this pattern of the world is about, to establish me as the king of my life, to say that I am the one capable and qualified to establish my way, my truth, and my life. But we have a king who said that he is the way, the truth, and the life. And he says no one comes to the Father, no one comes to this kingdom except through him. Right? This pattern is to believe that Jesus is not only the arbiter of this, that he is good and that he is trustworthy in this, that he is this good king. That we don't have to worry about the fact that in this world and in this life and in this pattern, it's not good. It is definitely not good for a single person to be the established authority over what is and over what is good, and it's certainly not good to establish what is good for me or good for a society as a whole. Right, but I would gladly establish this kind of king to be the sole arbiter of who I am, where I'm going, and who I want to be. I think that's a good place to stand. Let's stand up, please. None of this is to say that this is easy. In fact, again, I don't know about you fine people, but my life has proven that this is incredibly difficult. It's not easy to view people, to view other people the way Jesus does. It's not easy to love people the way Jesus loves them. It's not easy to speak the words that Jesus speaks. But I think that's what Paul is getting at in Romans chapter 12. Don't be conformed to that pattern any longer, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind. And this is a daily renewal, right? This idea that I'm going to wake up and know that it would be so much easier for me to choose this pattern and this life and this way, this truth and this life over here. But despite my sensibilities, despite my inner longing, despite my vices, my addictions, whatever this is, right? Despite that, I'm going to choose something that I trust and believe is better. And I'm not going to sit here and lie to you and tell you that this is an actual daily thing that I choose, because it's not, right? But this is the goal. To read the words of Jesus, to be inspired, to be transformed by them. To partner with people, to partner with other people who help you, right? With a spouse that challenges you daily and keeps you right and challenges you to be better, right? With friends and family members who are challenging you to be something better than you are, right? Even that doesn't make this a sure thing, but it's certainly a lot easier, right? Pray with me, please. Father, thank you for being such a good king, for establishing and chartering such a good kingdom, one that promises blessing, that promises satisfaction, that promises transformation, promises to be good and better than anything that I could establish for myself here on this earth and in this life and anything else that has been established for me on my behalf, even and especially the things vying for my attention and vying for my devotion and passing themselves off as something that is good and trustworthy, when we know it's not. We know, Lord, and we trust you are good. You are the arbiter of what is. You are the satisfaction of my soul. Help my unbelief. Help our unbelief, Lord. And help us daily, hourly, by the minute and second, Lord, to be people who just trust, even if we can't see it, even if we can't feel it, even if we can't even really fully know it, Lord. Just trust that your way is better, that your way, your truth, and your life is better. And follow this better pattern of living. In Jesus' name. Amen. Thank you all very much. I hope you have a great Sunday. The Lord bless you and keep you, and cause his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. May he lift his countenance up upon you and give you his peace. Thank you very much. Have a blessed Sunday.